All right, everyone. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. My daughter came in from Shanghai last night. We went to get a car. Get this. This is great, all right? We had to rent a car for her. So I said, I want a compact, you know, your typical whatever the cheapest one is. Okay, but there's none in yet. But there were maybe one in at like 4:30 or 5. I said, well, that'll be fine. It may be a pickup. I went, a what? It may be a pickup. I'm like, I don't think that's what I was thinking about. Oh, but we'll charge you the compact price. I don't want to drive a pickup for the next 3 weeks. So anyway, just to let you know, it's considered a pickup is a compact. Anyway, on that note, Mr. Barnes, on this Wednesday, hump day, November 6th, interesting election night.
How about Virginia?
Virginia, Kentucky, I tell you. And you know what was good about Kentucky? Did you listen to his announcement speech when he sort of said, thank you for electing me?
No, because it seemed a little early.
Well,
I know 100% of the votes were in, but he wasn't ahead by much, and the other guy hadn't conceded.
Well, the other guy won't concede just because he won't concede. He's been a jerk the whole time, which is why he lost. He lost more for being a jerk than for any other reason. I mean, I hate to say this. It's not that Bashir isn't a nice guy, and his father had been the governor, so it was right. Kind of like, you know, they were familiar with the name. He spent a lot of time talking about public education and teachers.
Good.
It was like he basically looked at the teachers and said, it's because of you I won. It was really, really amazing.
Wow.
And then one of the last things he said was, the most important thing for me as governor is to represent and support public education and to change the Board of Education. Ooh, I'm like going high five. All right.
And one of the reasons why teachers are the reason he won, because teachers educate the populace.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
And an educated populace is going to actually think before they vote.
Well, and they were going to take away their pension. I mean, the Republican governor was a total jerk.
Yeah. So speaking of the current president, I saw this really interesting article by a guy named Tom Englehart.
Oh, I know Tom.
And he's titled the article, The 19th Century Novel That Explains Trump to a T. Guess what that novel is?
Okay.
19th century novel.
Novel, all right.
There can be no question about it. Donald Trump is Lewis Carroll's Queen of Hearts.
Alice in Wonderland. Oh, how great.
Off with his head was the president's essential suggestion for the whistleblower who fingered him on that now notorious Ukrainian phone call.
Right.
And if the Donald hasn't also been playing the roles of White Rabbit, Mad Hatter, and other characters from Carroll's classic 19th century children's book, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, then tell me what he has been doing these last years.
Oh, wow.
Unfortunately, in attempting to explain the Trumpian world we've been plunged into, I'm not Lewis Carroll. If only I were. Still, I realized recently that, like Alice, I had gone down the proverbial rabbit hole and was still falling as if into a deep, deep well or through the very center of the earth. Now, Alice, if you remember, first had to follow a white rabbit with pink eyes who rushed by wearing a waistcoat, suddenly pulled a watch from its pocket and said to itself, oh, dear, I shall be too late, and then disappeared down that memorably large rabbit hole by a riverbank near her house in 19th century England. Well, willingly or not, I, and here I suspect I speak for most of the rest of us too, had little choice, given the election 2016, but to follow our own rabbit down a 21st century version of that rabbit hole.
Right.
Goes without saying that our rabbit, that famed impresario of unreality TV shows, was distinctly a white rabbit too.
Mm-hmm.
After all, he would be the first to assure you that he's no Mexican racist, nor a compatriot of the recently dead Congressman Elijah Cummings, whom he labeled a brutal bully representing a rat and rodent-infested District of Columbia.
Yeah.
No, Trump's a white rabbit.
A white rabbit. Oh,
in his own twitchy fashion, the president recently refused to throw out the first pitch of a World Series game in Washington, D.C., because he knew that the Secret Service would dress him up in a lot of heavy armor, as Donald put it, and he would look too heavy.
Oh, no, that's probably true.
In other words, he rejected his own armored version of a Lewis Carroll waistcoat, a Kevlar vest, because it might, he felt, make him seem fat. This sort of thing, now our everyday reality, even Lewis Carroll might have had trouble inventing. And if any of this seems petty to you, keep in mind that never in our history has there been a pettier or more self-absorbed president. On his introduction at that baseball game, by the way, he was greeted with a chorus of boos and, this is a first, chants of lock him up.
I know. I couldn't believe it.
What could be better than that?
I know.
He goes on about Alice's adventures in Wonderland and
Alice
finding herself in a room with this teeny little door that was too small to exit through. And he says, it seems to me that since 2016, all of us have found ourselves in just such a room.
Right.
Updated to include a Donald Trump Twitter account with no exit in sight.
Wow. Great. Now, where was this in? What was that? Where was the article from, the op-ed? Washington Post, New York Times? Where was it?
I think it was
Common Dreams?
In Common Dreams.
Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, you know, we're going to be celebrating. It's perfect.
It's witty and it's right on point.
I mean,
it's like you're in this Mad Hatter crazy – the Mad Red Queen, and we've got the Mad King Donald, you know?
But it's not like we are. That's what's so scary, is that it's one thing to say, oh, doesn't it feel like this? No, it is this.
Yeah.
It is this. It's just, it's remarkable. It is remarkable.
But let me just tell you that when he gets to the end of this piece, he points out that at the end of Alice in Wonderland, Alice comes up.
Right.
And she's returned to her normal size, and she's sitting by the riverbank in her merry old England countryside.
Thank you. Hope.
There is hope for us at the end of that tunnel.
Right, exactly. Well, yesterday was very, very interesting. And we're going to be doing a lot today about labor, which is so cool. This is all about unions. It's all about the raising the minimum wage for restaurant workers, our first one. Then Bob Henley is going to be talking about the labor movement, which is sort of finding a rebound. And if you saw what happened yesterday during the election, a lot of people pointed to unions saying thank you. And But I do have a really fun piece before we grab our first guest. So I saw this because one of our – Ralph, thank you so much for sending it to me on Facebook. It was an article that was entitled, "Remember the Cyclist Who Flipped Off Trump's Motorcade? She Just Won a Virginia Election." Remember? It's a great picture. So his motorcade is going by. She's on her bicycle. And as the motorcade is going by, you see her putting up her middle finger as the limousine goes by. It's really hilarious. It's a great picture. So I posted the article on Facebook. And I also wrote the following because I want you to know that, unfortunately, there is no camera here. So you cannot see what I'm doing. But I wrote this. Wow. A flip on steroids. This is the personification of yesterday's election. Today on the radio, I will raise my two middle fingers in stereo to honor her spirit and her success. So, ladies and gentlemen, voila, I am raising my two middle fingers in stereo. And as Ken Barnes will tell you, I do this a lot, which is why I love radio, because you can't see what I'm doing. I can just describe it to you, which is probably more appropriate. But someone said to me, oh, Arnie, you know, you're getting into the dirt like Donald Trump. You're getting more Trumpy in that way. And I said, you know, I don't think that's what I'm doing. I remember when I was running for governor back in 1992, someone said to me that my campaign slogan should be "No More BS." That was what they said in 92. So I have basically sort of embraced that idea of being kind of brutally honest here. And what Donald Trump has done is not get us into the gutter. Donald Trump doesn't know how to. He doesn't know how to lead. He doesn't know how to believe. He doesn't have a compass. He doesn't have a spine. He's a coward. He's just such a little petty child. Oh, it just makes me crazy. All right. So as I said, this is an important day because we're going to be talking a lot about workers, a lot about unions, a lot about success. And I saw a piece at The Conversation that was entitled "Raising the Minimum Wage in Restaurants Could Be a Win for Everyone." And I was like, wow, this is such a great story. Joining us on the phone is Nicole Hallett. Is it Hallett? Nicole, how do you pronounce
it? Yes, it's Hallett. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Arnie.
A professor of law at the University of Buffalo. She wrote her piece. She directs the Community Justice Clinic, which represents low-income residents of Buffalo on issues relating to workers' rights, consumer justice, immigration, civil rights, and government benefits. And, of course, her academic research focuses on the intersection between immigration, labor, and employment law. So here's what I want you to do, Nicole. Refresh everyone's recollection, because if you have never been a restaurant worker, I have, you don't know that the idea of raising the minimum wage for restaurant workers is a huge step, and especially in New York, where it went to $15 an hour, I believe. The idea is that restaurant workers actually earn have historically earned less than a minimum wage because the idea is they were able to receive tips and that therefore tips was going to be the way that they were going to be made whole. So walk us through a little bit about restaurant workers, their relationship with wages or not, and why what happened in New York may be an important piece of empirical data as we look at what we need to do, not only with raising the wage, but also raising the wage for restaurant workers, because they are in a relatively vulnerable position, and I don't think a lot of people appreciate it.
Yes. So traditionally, restaurant workers who receive tips have been allowed to get paid less than other workers. So if you look at the federal law right now, the minimum wage is $7.25 an hour. That hasn't gone up since 2009. But in fact, federally, the minimum wage only requires that restaurant owners pay their tipped workers $2.13 an hour, and that's a wage that hasn't gone up in decades. Now, some states have tried to raise the tipped minimum wage above that, and New York is one of those states. So right now in New York City, for example, the minimum wage for businesses that have 11 or more workers is $15 an hour. Wow. There is still a tipped minimum wage in New York City. So right now, if you are a tipped worker in New York City and you are working at a restaurant with more than 11 people, which is many restaurants, you are getting a wage from your employer of $10 an hour with the understanding that you will be making at least $5 an hour in tips. So it is a much higher wage in New York City right now than we see at the national level.
Okay, so let's remind everyone what this means for restaurant workers. I mean, when they hear $2 and what was it again?
What's $2.13 an hour. It's just extremely low.
It's so
and
disgusting.
Actually, when you take out taxes, if you're only making $2.13 an hour and they have to take taxes out, oftentimes workers aren't receiving a paycheck at all because it's all going to the government to pay for taxes.
Okay,
so,
it's
an extremely low wage.
It's embarrassing. So as I'm listening to you, here was my understanding, and maybe you can disabuse me of this. My understanding was that they were required at a minimum to pay you $2.13. But there was an assumption that with your tip income, you would then be able to achieve the $7.25 an hour, which is the minimum wage for everybody. Am I wrong here? But I thought that if you didn't get enough tips in that hour to get to $7.25, that the employer needed to make up the difference.
That is the law. So the law is that if you don't make up the tips and make up to the full minimum wage, the employer is supposed to cover the difference. The problem that we found with that system is that it's routinely that rule is routinely broken. So there are many tipped workers who in fact don't get their wages made up. It's a huge problem, and it's one reason why some of us, myself included, have advocated actually for just getting rid of the sub minimum wage and just requiring employers to pay tipped workers what they pay everybody else.
Okay, so let's talk about what's happened in New York. So New York still has a bifurcated system. So it's $15 for everyone over 11, but if you're working in a restaurant with over 11, it's 10. So now
Correct. Tell
me, that's still significantly higher than what they were probably being paid before. So what has been the effect within the restaurant industry? Have you heard people grumbling and bitching and moaning, oh my God, I can't keep people employed, I'm losing money, or has it turned out to be not as challenging as people were afraid of?
Well, it's interesting because before the changes went into effect, there was a lot of criticism from the restaurant industry who said that this would be produce apocalyptic conditions on the restaurant industry, that there would be massive closures and massive layoffs. And in fact, if you ask businesses now, they will say that it's been very difficult to implement. But if you look at the actual data, the restaurant industry in New York hasn't seen those negative effects. Employment is up, revenue is up. Of course, as always, there are restaurants that have closed and there are new ones that have opened. That's sort of
normal.
The normal churn of the restaurant industry. We know that it's a very tough business and many restaurants fail just naturally despite the fact, putting aside the minimum wage. But it hasn't caused the kind of sea change in the industry that people in the industry claimed it would. And in fact, we've seen that in New York. We've also seen that elsewhere in the country. There are seven states that have actually gotten rid of the tipped minimum wage and have fairly high minimum wages for their restaurant workers. And in fact, what studies have found in those places is that the restaurant industries are thriving, and also workers are thriving. So income among restaurant workers has gone up across the board. And so it just simply isn't the case that we've seen massive layoffs, and we haven't seen income drop, and we haven't seen restaurants close en masse. The predictions just haven't come to bear.
And let's remember, it's every restaurant worker in every restaurant with over 11. I mean, it's a level playing field. It's not like, you know, you're cherry picking. You know, you can go, well, I can go to this place because it's cheaper because they're paying people less. Honey bun. You know, it's everyone. It's all the McDonald's. It's all the Burger Kings. It's all the places that have over 11. As you point out, it's most of the places. And if it's a really tiny hole in the wall, they don't have to worry about that. And they're probably not making a lot of money. What I thought was fascinating is you quote something from the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. And you wrote, the focus on single restaurants also ignores the larger economic impact of raising the minimum wage. According to an analysis by the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, if low-wage workers have more money in their pockets, remember this, everyone, they will have more money to spend, potentially expanding the number of consumers who can afford to eat out. And it's not only that, you know that every additional dime they make is going back into the economy. I mean, they're not going to put it into their hedge fund, and they're not going to send it to Aruba. And I mean, it is so, and plus it means that they can be stable in their place of employment because they're now making enough that maybe they can actually pay their bills and not quit their jobs.
That's exactly right. And I mean, this is really an intuitive point, but it's one that I think gets lost sometimes in the discussion, which is that restaurants, in order to succeed, need consumers that are eating out. And if you have a large population of people who are literally just trying to make ends meet and pay their rent and their, you know, their utilities at the end of the month, that those aren't going to be consumers that are going to eat. And so it has a broader effect on the economy, not just to, you know, with the restaurant industry, but many industries. When workers have money to spend, particularly when you're talking about low-wage workers, as you say, they are going to be spending that money. They are going to be consumers, and they are going to then be drivers of economic activity above and beyond whatever effect they have on the businesses that they work for.
And you mentioned in your article that there are 7 states, including Alaska, Montana, and Washington, have already abolished the tip credit. So, and that it looks like if New York was able to get to 10, then it may be that New York will be able to get to 15 as well. So they, you know, that now that they've experienced it and there wasn't a shock to this to the system, people might be willing to do this. The other thing is, let's talk a little bit about something that a friend of mine has been working very hard in New Hampshire about this whole issue. And it's the idea that it's not just about pay stability for these workers, but it's about combating the problem of sexual harassment in the service industry. Will you flesh that comment out?
Sure. So one thing that has become clear as these other states have started to abolish the tip credit is something that wasn't entirely clear before, which is that servers, particularly female servers, when they are required to basically work for tips, are more vulnerable to sexual harassment by customers than they are if they don't need those tips in order to make a stable wage. We actually, there's some research out of California which shows that not only do sexual harassment rates go down when you raise the tip minimum wage, but also that reporting rates of sexual harassment within companies goes up. So you have workers who are more economically stable, who are not required to put up with sexual harassment in order to make ends meet at the end of the month, and so therefore have more agency to push back when it happens to them.
This is so important. And having been, I was a restaurant worker. I worked at a place called The Pump. You can't even imagine what it was like. And I will be honest with you. I mean, my boss basically almost said to me, wear a shorter skirt. And I'm thinking,
how does that make me serve beer better? When you need to make money with tips, you're willing to do things you wouldn't otherwise be willing to do in order to get that paycheck at the end of the night. And we shouldn't be expecting workers to do that. It's just, it's not a good policy across the board. Not only do we have the fact that many employers don't actually make sure their workers are making enough in tips to make up to the minimum wage, and not only do you have the problem of kind of unstable income, so you don't know what your income is going to be week to week, but then you're at the mercy of customers, many of whom might make a tip contingent on how you react to a potential sexual harassment situation.
Right. And it goes beyond sexual harassment, too, because you're afraid to report any adverse terms and conditions of your employment. That's why unions came into being, in addition to raising wages, is that obviously if your boss just treats you badly, treats you arbitrarily, and doesn't give you things that you deserve or makes you grovel and do things not even sexual, if you're intimidated and afraid you're going to lose your job, you are not going to complain about any of these things, which leads me to actually be, I saw that you're an immigration expert as well, and I was wondering how this all affects immigrants, because immigrants take low-wage jobs, and especially in restaurants.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Chinatown as we're talking right now.
How does the fact that non-immigrants are able to have a better life as a waitstaff or other restaurant employee, how does that affect the ability of immigrants to get jobs?
Well, there are many immigrants that work in the restaurant industry. They are actually more likely to be back of the house staff than they are to be front of the house staff, although, of course, that's not uniformly the case. But the largest problem with immigrant workers, actually, more so than what the minimum wage is set at, is that they are more likely to be victims of wage theft because sometimes their legal ability to work is precarious. They may have status issues. Employers use that to take advantage of them, and so pay them less because they know that those workers, A, are not going to complain because they're worried about getting deported, and B, don't necessarily have that many other options if they get fired from one job to go across the street and get a job somewhere else. So, the minimum wage applies to immigrant workers, both documented and undocumented. The law is very clear about that, but in practice, a large percentage of immigrant workers actually end up making less than the minimum wage, even when the minimum wage goes up.
So I just have one quick question. So we still, at least in New York, and except for the other seven states that have basically eliminated the idea of the restaurant worker wage, how does an employer or an employee prove what their tip is? Are you required to put it into, your name with a tip jar? Are you required to put all your tips on a credit card? I mean, how do they even prove it?
Well, that's a good point. So they are supposed to keep records that document how much each worker is receiving in tips. That doesn't always happen because for many reasons, some employers, it's cumbersome to keep track of tips and to make sure that you're counting cash tips and credit card tips and all of these things. I think also employers, kind of make assumptions that, well, I'm sure they're making enough to make up for it.
Exactly.
But then you also have employers who basically don't want to know because they don't want to have to make it up if they aren't getting enough to make up to the minimum wage.
And do you take FICA out of the tip?
So record keeping is a huge problem.
Right. Do you take FICA out of the tip? You must.
I'm sorry?
Do you take FICA out of the tip?
Well, they're supposed to. I mean, they're supposed to record it and take taxes out of it.
Yeah.
That is the law, but that doesn't always happen.
I feel like this is a situation of a variation on don't ask, don't tell. I don't remember, and this is many years ago that I was a tip worker, but I don't remember after each client that there was a place where I would write down what my tip was or what I received. I never remember my boss ever asking me. So I'm just wondering if there's even a standard for the industry. I mean, what is the reporting requirement for the employee? What is the expectation on the part of the employer? It sort of catches catch can. There is no sort of plan that you're supposed to put in place. Therefore, it's sort of individual based on the restaurant owner.
Well, I mean, it's clear that it's the restaurant owner's responsibility to do this. I mean, it's not the worker's responsibility to put a system into place to keep track of tips.
Sure.
That really does need to be the restaurant owner. But I think you're pointing out that the service industry is it's a little messy in that way. You know, I mean, you're kind of dealing with a lot of different things, and because record keeping tends to not be the best in that industry, that's another reason to make sure that people are getting a base wage which is high enough to be livable on. Because we don't want to depend on bad record keeping to make sure that people don't, you know, end up in poverty because their tips weren't enough 1 month.
I think that should almost be, everyone knows it's very messy. I mean, that is, in a lot of ways, people, as soon as you start saying that, people go, oh, yeah, that's right. How would they know? Oh, my God. And all of a sudden, then it becomes rational to make sure that they get this kind of requisite minimum wage, like the $15 in New York as opposed to the 10 to the 15, that people would suddenly realize, yes, I would want that too. Because I think, I mean, if you don't even need to ever have been in the industry to probably understand exactly how complicated this is and why people could get harmed by it. And that's not the point. The point is you want someone to work hard. You also want them to be compensated.
That's right. And just another point that we haven't raised yet, but I think is worth mentioning, is the fact that different workers receive different levels of tips based on factors that we would think are probably illegitimate. So the research is very clear that female servers, particularly older female servers, receive less tips. And also servers of color across the board receive less in tips. And these are probably due to the implicit biases of the customers. But we should ask ourselves whether we want to endorse a system that pays workers different amounts based on, you know, innate characteristics that they can't change.
I love you. I love you. Nicole, keep writing this stuff. Nicole Hallett is an associate professor of law at the University at Buffalo at the State University of New York. Her piece at theconversation.com, raising the minimum wage in restaurants could be a win for everyone. Amen. Thank you so much, Nicole. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Chow. Oh, and guess what? A little labor history is next. Totally appropriate. Here we go.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1982. That was the day that 11 women graduated from the New York City Fire Academy. They were the first women firefighters ever to serve in the city of New York since the department was founded in 1865. The inclusion of women firefighters did not come easily in New York. In 1977, for the first time, women were allowed to apply to be firefighters. Although many women had passed the written part of the exam, they were continually denied employment because they failed the physical test. The women sued, citing discrimination. One of the leaders of the suit was applicant Brenda Berman. The Federal District Court in Brooklyn sided with the women. Not everyone was happy about the decision. A group of demonstrators came to City Hall before the graduation with signs reading, quote, "I want to be saved by firemen." The Uniformed Firefighters Association also challenged the ruling. They tried to block the ceremony in the courts, arguing that training requirements had been changed to accommodate the women. Despite the legal challenges, the ceremony went on as scheduled. In his speech, Mayor Ed Koch said, quote, "As all of us have known all along, bravery and valor know no sex." After the graduation, the controversy over women firefighters continued. The women often faced sexual harassment on the job and vilification on the editorial pages of the city's newspapers. Bumper stickers reading, quote, "Don't send a girl to do a man's job," could be seen on the car bumpers of many male firefighters and at the city's firehouses. The women firefighters stood up to the harassment, testifying before the city council and holding street demonstrations to bring awareness to the discrimination.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In 2018, five electric school buses hit the streets of White Plains, New York. They provide a quiet ride with no tailpipe emissions. Soon, they'll do even more. Ari Khan is with Con Edison, the utility serving White Plains. He says as electric buses became available,
we were able to kind of come in and say, now that a school bus is electric, what other capabilities does it have?
Con Edison is leading a pilot project to use White Plains buses as a backup energy source. In the summer, when they're not being driven, the buses can charge up at night, and then the electricity stored in the batteries can be sent back to the grid as needed. Khan says this can help the utility meet demand for electricity at peak times, such as hot afternoons when air conditioners are running. One bus does not provide a lot of power, but there are almost 500,000 school buses in the U.S., so Khan says it's a strategy that could be scaled up. The utilities would pay for the electricity, so Khan says the arrangement could help school bus operators recoup some of the cost of an electric bus.
They have an opportunity to make money using their school buses as summertime batteries.
Khan says it's just one added benefit of investing in clean buses for kids across the country. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Good memories are forever, said the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if you come to strip our rights away, we'll give you hell every time. This is a union town, a union town.
Ooh, I like this song. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Ken Barnes picks our music. Who sings This is a Union Town? I didn't know that song.
A guy named Tom Morello.
Wow.
And yeah, treat us wrong and the union's going to kick your butt.
Well, they used to be able to kick your butt. Anyway, speaking of unions, I have been sort of waxing poetic because we actually did a conversation about tip workers and the minimum wage. And now we're being joined by Bob Hennelly, who wrote a piece at Salon.com, again on the union theme. There is a national labor uprising happening right now that the media isn't reporting. Decades of wealth concentration and corporate domination leave unions no other choice. Welcome to the program, Bob. How are you?
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, let me just say something. I called a friend of mine this morning and I said, did you hear the newly elected governor of Kentucky last night in his speech, you know, when after he got, we still think he's won, even though it's only 5,000 votes, but that's still significant. And I said, listen to who he thanked. And he spent a lot of time, guess what? Thanking teachers and teachers' unions, all right? And it was like, I mean, he, honest to God, he must have said it a couple of times during the course of the conversation. He talked about union workers. He talked about teachers. He talked about how important it was. And I wrote this on my Facebook page because I just thought it was so, I was emotional as I was listening to Andy Beshear talk. And I wrote, in 1989, the Kentucky courts ordered the state to change how they funded education. The Democratic governor said the following in response to the ruling. Now geography is a subject to be taught, not a factor that determines the quality of a child's education. That was the Democratic governor in 1989. Last night, the newly elected Democratic governor told the audience he won because of teachers and public education unions, and that was his top priority. And he was about to appoint a new board of education. So as I heard that, you mentioned that the media isn't paying attention. In a lot of ways, they didn't notice that aspect of his speech, and I did, Bob. And they wrote about everything but that. And I was like, oh, my God, it is about what unions are doing, and they're rising up everywhere, and especially teachers' unions are really laying a foundation for what I think is a refreshed movement.
So one of the things that, and I totally, that's a brilliant observation, of course, the one thing that I would add was his reference to the Fraternal Order of Police.
Yes.
And that is the secret sauce. That is the winning Bobby Kennedy coalition of yesteryear, and I date myself, I am old, that really, I call it the mainstream consensus, Main Street consensus or MLK Boulevard consensus. When the Fraternal Order of Police, when your firefighters, when your first responders are in common cause with your teachers, social workers, and doctors, the Republican Party is revealed as the marginal Donald Trump cult that it is.
Yes. No. I heard that as well. And let's remember that the governor of Wisconsin tried to divide the unions up by basically dividing the teachers and the social workers and whatever from the firefighters and the police. That was the wedge that they tried. Frankly, he was successful at it in being able to divide it. And so when you heard Beshear last night threading them together in hour one. In hour one, it was absolutely brilliant. And I think that I'm glad that you noticed it and I noticed it. I'm just really pissed off that the national media, I went to the Washington Post, they mentioned a little bit about public education. But they didn't really hear what I thought was a remarkable emphasis on it, because it really was, so full-throated and so important. And that's why I went back to that decision in 1989 when another Democratic governor also talked about public education and recognizing its import. And now we are, 20 years later, hearing a very similar theme happening, and a Democrat is actually able to rebound despite Donald Trump showing up in the state.
But, of course, you can't be surprised that the media is not covering important stuff that's going on. I saw an article just yesterday about Bernie Sanders' campaign complaining vehemently that the media sort of erasing him.
Right. Exactly. So it's important.
The media doesn't cover most of the important stuff that's going on in the world.
So let's talk about the unions finding their voice again, the unions getting more credibility. I think if you talk to young people now, there's a very different sense of how important the labor movement is, and if you talk to the same group of folks even 15 years ago.
Oh, I think that we have to separate it into the pre-Ronald Reagan PATCO 1980 period from the post-PATCO period, and by frame of reference, I mean the mass firing that Ronald Reagan did when air traffic controllers were organized and trying to press for a better circumstance, both for the flying public and for themselves professionally. The president, in a shot heard around the world, summarily fired them all and basically broke the back of organized labor. And at that point, there was a situation where public sector and private sector unions were dealing with the fact that this, whatever level of government or private sector you're at, this anti-worker thing that really was unchallenged, Reagan made it stick, sent this message that capital was going to run the show and that labor would be lucky if they had a job. And so I think part of this is, if you go back and look at the data points, and this is all just data-driven. In the 1970s, you had a situation where there's a split. You had productivity and the beginnings of technology that we know today making workers tremendously productive and making capital and ownership, minting millionaires and billionaires at a rate that is really unknown in human history.
Yeah.
And at that exact same time, we saw wages go flat or decline. And what was done, and this is the betrayal of both parties, Republican and Democrat, is they cynically substituted household debt instead.
Yeah.
So instead
household
of earned
debt.
Income,
right.
mm. instead of earned income that our forebears were able to make, our ancestors were able to make, they came up with the insidious concept of second mortgages. Put your home's value to work today for tomorrow. All of that.
Oh, my God.
And now if you look at the commercials on television, in the corporate news media, that's what they're selling. They're selling the diminishment of earned income and the ever-expansion of consumer and corporate debt. That's
oh my
all
God.
They got to sell.
And, we haven't had that conversation for a long time, Bob. I think we didn't realize. One of the things I saw happening when wages went flat is that, and it also it happened at a very interesting time as well. Because let's remember what occurs in 1970. In 1970 is the feminist movement, the women's movement.
Right.
And one of the things that the women wanted to do was they wanted to be able to enter the workforce and create equality. Well, what a perfect timing for that. Because if you're going to be slashing their spouse's wages, then guess what? They are going to have to enter the workforce. So in a bizarre way, they were both driven there by the feminist ideals. They're also sucked into it because they couldn't pay the mortgage with just the spouse's income. It needed two in order to do it. Yes, they could take on more debt, but it still needed two incomes to do what one income had historically been able to do.
And what else happened under that period of time? The volunteer army.
Yes.
That's right. End of the draft. Let's not impose on the country, and then we can continue to have armed conflict around the world because it's just another lifestyle choice.
We need to make the movie, Bob. I think people forget if they could see the pieces of this puzzle, they would realize how they were getting shafted. I remember giving a speech once to a bunch of public unions in New Jersey, and I talked about the idea of, you know, women entering the workforce, and I said, here's the problem, boys and girls. The problem is now it doesn't take two to actually pay the bills. It takes a menage a trois. You know, I mean, and the trois is either your kid enters the workforce or it's debt. And that is the third person. The third person is accumulated debt. It's debt for you with credit cards. It's debt for your kid with what happens with college. I mean, think about what we have done.
It's your lifelong partner.
It's your lifelong partner. Yeah. Well, that's your next piece. That's your next piece. It's your lifelong partner. I freaking love it.
It's also a great way to create social control.
Yes.
And that's what this is all
social
about.
Social control.
They did debt as social control.
Yes.
They understood out of the 60s. They were very smart. When people were getting college educations that were affordable and didn't like the direction of the country, they got up and stopped a war. They did not want to see that repeated, Arnie.
Right.
And so they made it so that you had to have an investor circle just to be able to afford the freshman year at a state college.
Oh my God, Bob! It's your third. Oh my God, you got to write that next piece about it, because I think if people begin to see this. But let's talk about the fact that. So, what was the driver? Was it unions recognizing that now was their opportunity, or was it the base and people who were feeling harmed and disenfranchised? Because I will tell you something that I sort of see with teachers' unions. I don't see it as the union leadership leading the fight. I see it as the base, the teachers themselves basically saying, we're fighting. And that it's more of a push from the bottom than a pull from the top. Am I, like, not seeing it correctly?
Well,
or does it feel that way?
I think that things of this scale happen for a confluence of reasons.
Right.
And so I think that extinction is a real incentive.
Extinction.
And so when you saw unions hold in the workforce declined considerably, 50s, 60s, 70s, and then the only bright spot really was in the public sector.
Right.
And then you saw at the same time this, and this is again both political parties. I know that, you know, that's not cool to say that now because we're only supposed to like hate Republicans, love Democrats. That's a memorandum. I didn't get it, but I have a long memory, and I remember they facilitated the global economy. We're going to be in it to win it. We're all going to be competitive, mm-hmm. and we're going to get that PhD, and then we'll be able to be, you know, captains of the universe. And what they did was permitted, with the tax code, major multinational corporations that got their start here in the United States to dismantle their physical plants and move it to places where there are no environmental or labor regulations, and then permit them, because they are a beneficent two-party bilking system, to hide their profits from the entire enterprise in the Cayman Islands.
Exactly.
Did I leave anything out?
No. It's so seamless. It's so sweet.
Haven't mentioned racism, but yeah.
But
that's the bonus.
Right. It is. That's the bonus. But as we're looking at this, is really interesting is that it does seem that the teachers around the country are even driving this in a way that historically I've never seen before. And I'm just wondering, is it that we trust our educators more than we trust anyone else? Is it that educators are now sort of revealing what parents kind of knew anyway?
I think that, not to cut you off, because it is your show and I want to come back, but the thing that you have to look at is they are on the front lines of this deterioration of the American circumstance, which is also not reflected in what we see. What do I mean by that? Well, we've spoken about this before, but it deserves repeating since it's ignored everywhere else, that we've had a life expectancy decline on average three times in a year now.
Right.
That's right. Americans are living on average less. Shorter life, they're living more of a shorter lifespan. Oh joy. That would be something we'd say about a developing country showed they really needed to get their act together. But here, because of course we have the best medical system in the world, no one talks about the fact that as far as deliverables, not so much. And so teachers on the front lines of the dissolution of the American family, of all the different issues
that
children now are being given en masse all kinds of pharmaceutical psychotropic drugs so they can pay attention and learn their ABCs, because people can't be at home and be with them so that they can get a frame of reference for the world, because everybody's got to be out making money.
Well, you know,
and so that's what teachers see. So teachers are doing things like digging in their pockets. I'm on a roll now.
You are.
Teachers dig into their own pockets to pay for the kinds of things kids need in terms of backpacks, in terms of supplies, and then they were picked on. And that was a mistake that Governor Christie and Mr. Governor Walker made, who are now private citizens making a fortune doing we don't know what kind of evil, but they made them pariahs.
And that was the big mistake on the part of the Republican governor in Kentucky. He did exactly the same thing. He threatened their pensions. He treated them like crap. The school board was just basically anti-teacher. I mean, it was all these things, and he thought that somehow that would do it. And in an interesting way, we looked at, you know, the suburbs are the place where we're seeing the swing, and people are talking about the suburbs vis-a-vis Donald Trump. Well, for the suburbs, it's also about public education. You know, they really do get it, and they really are committed to it, and they do see what the teachers are seeing, and they recognize it, and they realize that if we don't support what's happening in our public schools, it's our children that will be sacrificed. And that's the last thing they want to see happen.
Well, the other thing, too, is that, again, this is how the mainstream corporate media missed the election of Donald Trump, which was that the social slide of the United States across zip codes, red or blue states, doesn't matter, is a consequence of the fact that now poverty has come to suburbia.
Yes.
And this isn't widely discussed either. So what you have is the situation where this dislocation is being felt throughout the country after the 2008 housing collapse and the loss of $20 trillion of American household wealth, which we also don't talk about. All eyes forward, supposedly the economy is growing, but not in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
And so as a consequence of that, teachers were the last bastion of the social contract. And so in Chicago, it's instructive, is they were in the mix for better working conditions, but also for more librarians, school nurses, and social workers, which used to be the province of elected officials, but they lost their way because they were busy raising money for the next campaign.
So in the piece at Salon.com where Bob Henley writes, there's a national labor uprising happening right now that the media isn't reporting, which is why we get to Bob, because he does report on it. And you write, whether it be a red state like West Virginia, where teachers in a right-to-work state successfully won a strike, or in Chicago, where teachers went out for 11 days, union members are now willing to put something at risk, not only to advance their own circumstance, but that of their communities that for too long have been neglected by the political system. Let's remember the Chicago teachers, as you point out, it wasn't about compensation as much as it was about smaller class sizes, more nurses, more social workers, more librarians. I mean, this is about what's good for kids and good for families.
And for student population, as the Times reporting pointed out, 72% of which are suffering of economic hardship in their lives.
Right.
So this slide, you know, I'm calling you from New York City, a supposedly progressive city that has, they estimate, some 100,000, close to 100,000 for 4 years in a row, homeless children going to school in New York City, about 30,000 in shelters and 70,000 in makeshift circumstances day to day. That's a difficult way to learn if you don't know where you're going to put your head down at night. And that's a circumstance in Bill de Blasio's New York City in 2019.
So, Bob, my daughter just flew in from Shanghai. And the last time she was here, she had decided to go and sort of sit in on an elementary school in New Hampshire. Now, let me just share something. New Hampshire's a very wealthy state. We're the seventh richest state in the nation. We're very white, we're very affluent, highly educated. But unfortunately, like West Virginia, we have something in common, which is we have a huge addiction problem, okay? And I think West Virginia is number one. New Hampshire still may be number two when it comes to overdoses and addiction. Well, one of the things that she came home with, and she was hysterical the last time she was here, was that when she went into the first and second grade teachers, one of the things that she learned from them was how different the classroom was. And we're not just talking size, although size could be one of the issues. It was the number of children now in the classroom whose parents were dead, addicted, basically were being raised by grandparents. And the number used to be, I mean, there was always a small number in a classroom, two or three. Now the number was five or seven.
To replicate what I've observed in my reporting in places like Newark.
Exactly.
Inner city collapse. now happening throughout the rest of the country.
Exactly. Yeah, precisely. And I think when you hear that, and I want people to hear it, this is New Hampshire. This is an affluent state. This was in a good school, quote-unquote good school. And teachers were actually thinking of walking. And the reason they were thinking of walking is they have more challenging kids in their classroom, representing a bigger percentage of those kids. Are they getting anything in the way of additional help? They do need the social workers. They do need the librarians. They absolutely need a school nurse. But look at these classrooms. They're being so compromised because how do you teach when such a high percentage of your kids are coming from such dysfunctional families and, frankly, probably have an addiction problem themselves because when they were born in utero, their parents were addicted?
Well, one of the things, though, would be instructive is I think that in from my experience of doing advance for various campaigns in New Hampshire, I do remember this rural poverty thing and also the working poor, that are folks that don't show up on the register of the as being officially below the poverty line, but are, like so many Americans, tens of millions of Americans, are one paycheck away from disaster.
Right.
And that cohort has been growing across the country.
Absolutely.
And that's what Donald Trump promised to fix, and he's made it worse. And Democrats need to focus on that because that's just the data doesn't lie. And we've seen the concentration of wealth and what happened with that tax cut make all the things we're talking about even more problematic.
But you know what was so sad, and I want to just read the last two lines in your piece and then comment on the election last night. You wrote, it was this kind of steady deterioration of our national circumstance that Trump exploited in 2016. In the years since his election, wealth concentration has continued and the income gap has grown wider. So it has fallen to labor to punch above its weight on behalf of the American people who've been cut adrift by a political system captive to corporate interests. Amen. Amen. But what is so amazing is even when you start talking about these things, look at rural Kentucky, the place that had their teeth kicked in, the place where they don't have the job replacement, the place that is hurting more than anything, where probably I would love to see what the average age is declining in rural Kentucky. And they went fanatically for Trump and fanatically for the Republican governor. And I am just trying to figure out, how do you have a conversation with them? Are they so bludgeoned into believing that nobody will give a crap about them, that they'd rather believe the angry Trump and the angry governor than believe that what they're doing is making their lives worse?
Do you want me to respond to that? Because that was a great soliloquy.
You give good ones too, Bob. We're so good at this together, you know?
That's right.
Like the dueling monologues.
But then there's sometimes when just silence and music is what's supposed to happen, and
But what do we do?
I think that a full steam ahead in the sense that we this idea of even if you're not in union, developing consciousness where you work, engaging with the people that you work with,
right,
having conversations about your common struggle, putting it something at risk for the community, that is, and that's really something you can do in place. And those
right
are the things that need to happen.
Right.
And that's just something that we're seeing. We are seeing where all kinds of companies that don't have unions all of a sudden are being held accountable by a workforce that is saying, oh, you say that you're supposed to be environmentally friendly or conscious. This policy isn't working. And then they create an issue. So I do think there's a much bigger space out there that's going on that can overthrow this corrupt pyramid. And that's what we're stuck under, this corrupt wealth pyramid that has been constructed over a half a century. And it's now time for the slaves to take it apart.
Well, as
can I
say,
go now?
You can go now, Bob. But let me just say something. What was I reading about? Was it Apple or Amazon or Google or somebody now creating a housing opportunity, realizing that affordable housing was a challenge for them? And what I was so appalled by.
Two and a half billion, exactly,
is that now the government basically has been drained of all its resources, basically doesn't do anything that HUD used to do.
Oh,
now,
don't get me started.
I know. So at some point we have to talk about that because I don't want a Amazon replacement. I don't want a Google replacement. They do not replace government. They do not, you know, because in the end, that means not only do they control the outcomes, not only do they target where they're going to make that investment, but in the end, they continue to then drain more resources out because, after all, look what we're doing for you. No, thank you. Bob Hennelly, thank you so much.
Before you let Bob go, I know you want to go, Bob. Yeah. Let me ask you if you can tie together the advice you were just talking about with raising consciousness of working people and raising their voices, to tie it to people in, let's say, the middle class or even professionals. I'm active in Concord with a couple of grassroots groups, and there are good-hearted people who want to help make society work better. And don't you think that raising some of these issues in their consciousness and having them be active and speaking about them to our legislature or our candidates for governor or whatever, and there are more people, and they're influential,
Is that for me?
Yes.
I guess I would say that one of the things that still has yet to happen is during the Vietnam War period, we had a situation where municipal governments were engaged in the anti-war effort. Yeah. And so one of the things that needs to happen is we've been in this never-ending war on terrorism that just goes unchallenged, right? Mm-hmm. So you need to have local municipal governments engaged in these choices. And so you localize these things of national import. I mean, because clearly what's part of the problem we have with Trump is that for 18 years, the entire Congress of both parties has been missing in action while they got themselves elected again and again. Mm-hmm. But they let this executive presidency grow into this behemoth that now torments us all.
Exactly.
And that's the problem. So we need to get back to the local council level and speak to these more global issues to start projecting power where it matters, where we live.
Bob Hennelly has written a reporter for The Village Voice, Pacifica Radio, WNYC, CBS, Money Watch, and other outlets. Of course, he also hangs out with me.
Don't forget that, right?
I don't know. And with the
Stuck Nation.
Right. And he is now a reporter for The Chief Leader, covering public unions and civil service in New York City. And, of course, you have to put my name on here, too, now, whenever you write for Salon. And I hang out with Arnie on The Attitude. All right. Thank you so much, Bob Hennelly. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
So, Bob, we're going to end with Solidarity Forever,
which
I hope you'll like, by Pete Seeger.
He will love it.
Blood shall run. There can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes strong.
It is we who plowed the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. Now we stand outcast and starving mid the wonders we have made, but the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever.
Taken untold millions that they never toiled to earn, but without our brain and muscle, not a single wheel can turn. We can break their haughty power, gain our freedom when we learn that the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever.
In
our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of atoms magnified a thousandfold. We can bring to birth a new world from the ashes of the old, for the union makes us strong.